Welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast, where we meet entrepreneurial artists who share their stories as we discuss everything storytelling. I'm Chris Sissons.
And I'm Gemma Rosenthal of Creative Hearts. And on today's show, we'll explore the alchemy of well-being, of the seasons, and the place we live.
This time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Robin Harris. Robin brings a unique perspective to the process of well-being and disease in our lives. She worked as an interpreter for many years and has seen and experienced stress and burnout in herself and her colleagues. Robin decided to look for ways in which she could support herself to let go of anxiety and the beliefs and fears that were holding her back, allowing her to thrive. She now supports others by helping them to interpret the messages from their own body in order to find a deeper sense of understanding, clarity, and purpose. Working from a holistic perspective, she believes that we can draw a lot of wisdom from the natural world and from the animals who share our lives. Her passions include sharing the wisdom of our body and how we can learn its vocabulary in order to optimize the health and well-being. She explores this not only for people, but for animals too. So welcome to Find, Tell, Share, Robin.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to be here with you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. And Robin, you first contacted Gemma through Words of the Wise. It's a book that we've mentioned several times in past episodes of this podcast. And I had a look at your contribution, which is a letter from your soul self.
Yes.
That's right, soul self. And I was wondering if you could explain what you mean by soul self.
I think people use various different names: higher self, true self. Soul self is just one that I use. For me, it's the part of us that never stops. It's always there. And I believe that energy is neither created nor destroyed. So even when we die in our physical form currently, something still, some energy is still there. And wherever that goes, whatever it does. But I guess that is part of the whole of the universe, the abundance of the universe and creation to me. And that is what one aspect, I guess, of what I think of as soul self, the bit of us that's eternal, that's part of the whole of life. And that's the part of us that knows who we really are and just wants to support us to step into that, because we've all had a lot of conditioning and things that have happened in our lives that maybe slightly take us off our best self. But our soul self is there just wanting to guide us back gently, compassionately, lovingly, to allow us to be our best selves and to shine that light. Because when we do that, it uplifts everybody else. So it's like, if you think of evolution wants life to continue and to grow and to expand. And for me, spirit wants the same thing. It just wants to know itself more and more and more fully in physical form.
As a storyteller, I sometimes want to depict the self, I think an excusable shortened version. And the traditional way of doing that, and it comes up in Gustav Jung's writing, is either an older person, which could be male or female, and it doesn't matter what sex you are, it could be either whatever sex you are, or a child. And I think sometimes stories about relationships between grandchildren and grandparents are often very moving. And I think there's something in there for that reason. So how do you see the self? I mean, I know it's sort of a sort of spiritual thing, but if you were to visualize it, what would you see?
That depends, I think, on the person. I do Reiki. I'm a Reiki practitioner. And quite often when I'm sharing Reiki with somebody, I will see an image of them, and I guess I think of that as being their best self, their soul self, and it'll be them in their prime, whatever that might manifest as. And it's quite often somebody who's full of energy, full of light, full of wisdom, and not young. So I wouldn't generally see a child, but it wouldn't be an old person either. It would be somebody, I guess, around 30 to 50. When we are still young in spirit, but also have that wisdom that comes with older age.
Yes, I think Jung called the older person and the younger person archetypes.
Yeah.
And I think what he meant by that was that they're typically what people see. But it's obviously, it's probably true for nobody, but just typically, you know, across the population.
Yeah.
It's the collective unconscious, I think he called it, which is really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, the other thing that fascinated me, Robin, was your work with animals, and particularly horses. Now, I know Gemma has a wonderful relationship with horses that upstage her in her videos.
Sorry, I was trying to think, what do you mean? Just in a video, I have a horse that comes in the video.
The horse became quite a feature by accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, was it accidental or was it the horse's design?
Well, that's what I thought it was. I thought that the horses had come to be in, not obviously, I don't know, they don't, not thinking, oh, we're going to be in this video, but it was just about, I'm going to talk a little bit later on about like nature and the seasons, and I think as well animals, they want to be involved in our lives and connect, and I feel anyway, and so tell us a little bit about your work with horses and how, because you'll probably know more than I do in terms of how to connect with horses. I know you've got some videos on it on YouTube.
For me, horses have a very special energy. They're huge animals and they have such power and strength, but they carry that with such grace, and they can teach us how to do the same. Because quite often we are either afraid of our power and we hide it away, or we use power over people rather than power with. And we see things in hierarchies, whereas horses, we're taught that they do, and that they have a lead mare or a lead stallion, but often they work as a herd and they'll move as a herd. So you'll see them, if they get a fright or something, they all move as one. And they just seem to know on some energetic level what everybody else in the herd is doing. And if you watch them when they're grazing or resting, they've got different horses facing all different directions so that they've got eyes everywhere. So they can teach us that. They can teach us how to work together as a collective, which often as human beings in Western society, we've lost that. And just their gentleness as well is something that really supports us. And there's a thing called entrainment where we can do to the horses, or they can share with us, relaxation and a slower heartbeat and breathing and getting us into rest and repair rather than fight or flight.
So let's go on to hear your story, Robin.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris. And it's interesting listening back to that introduction that you did for me. I think it's going to tie in with this story quite well, because in the introduction you were talking about how I have a different perspective on well-being quite often to what the mainstream would say, and how I support people to interpret the messages that their body is sending. And basically that's what my story is about. Because about 2 weeks ago now, my skin in particular areas of my body started to feel really sensitive. And I thought, I wonder if I'm getting shingles. That just came up for me. And then a couple of days later, the blisters and the rash and everything appeared. So that kind of confirmed Yes, I've got shingles. And so I decided I was going to explore this in the way that I would do with people who come to me, to see what the messages, the vocabulary was saying to me. So I looked at where I was experiencing the rash, because it was in specific areas. So my right leg and my ankle on that side, and the very bottom of my back, on all on that same side. And from the work that I do, I know that the particular tissue and the particular location have such information to give us. And you can just look at something quite often, and how would you describe it is what it can show for you. So one of the things that came up was that my skin looked really angry. So that was something to take note of. It was my right hand side, and I am right wired. So that means it's something to do with my yang energy, which includes my outward life rather than my inner world. So it could be male figures, can be boss, can be work. Those are the things to look at. And I knew as well that it was painful, it was inflamed, and I was feeling really fatigued. And often we are told by the medical profession that sickness and symptoms are something where our body's going wrong, it's made a mistake. For me, it's part of a well-being process. And those symptoms that I was experiencing, the pain, the inflammation, the exhaustion, fatigue, those come actually when our body is healing. So I know that I've been in stress, I've been holding some stress up to that point, and now my body, for some reason, has been able to shift into rest and repair. And basically, it's detoxing, and skin is our biggest detox organ. So all of this stuff I've been carrying is coming out through my skin in that very particular area. Like I was saying, my leg, so it's yang energy, but also what does my leg represent to me? It's movement. It's moving away from or towards something. So that was another thing that I could put into my set of clues. And then I turned to Louise L. Hay. You know Louise Hay's books, You Can Heal Your Body, You Can Heal Your Life. And in there, she has an A to Z list of a lot of different conditions to let you know what is the meaning behind them. And for shingles, she says that it's waiting for the other shoe to fall. It's when you have fear and tension and you're just waiting for what's the next horrible thing that's going to happen. And it's also about being sensitive. So the sensitivity of my skin was reflecting an inner sensitivity, an emotional sensitivity that I'd been carrying. I also have been having a lot of pain around my sacroiliac joint. And that, I'm aware, is to do with self-devaluation, feeling that you've lost power and feeling worthless. So I was able to take all of those and put those clues together and then look at my life and see, well, where have those things been happening in my life? Where have I been carrying that energy? And it gave me real insight into what has been going on for me. But also I was able to see why at that point did I get sick? Why did the shingles start then? Because as I say, something would have tipped me into rest and repair. Why did I suddenly come out of all of that stress and my body suddenly be able to detox and to heal? And looking at what it was healing from, I was able to realize, gosh, I've been reading Gabor Mate's latest book, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture. And in there, he talks about what trauma is, as in not the big traumas, not the ones we maybe think of, like the car crash or the bereavement or the war, but the traumas that are the so-called little things that build up over time. And those were, for me, the frustrations and the tensions and the fears that I've been holding. And reading his book, I came to understand how much I was still holding, the hypervigilance I still had, from my childhood, from the things that I was told, literally told, the world is a big, bad, scary place. That was very frightening to me as a child. And I took that on board and I believed that. That was a belief that I held. Reading this book helped me to see that. So I had decided, using the techniques that I use in my work, I would create a space of safety for me that would counterbalance and start to address that fear that I've been holding. And doing that took me into rest and repair and allowed my body to detox. So what I love to share with people is that our symptoms aren't the body going wrong, and they're actually the point at which our body is rebalancing. It's a good thing. It's not always a comfortable thing, but it's a positive thing that our body is doing. And to celebrate the fact that our body is just seeking to get back to balance and to get back to well-being, and it knows how to do that. So for us, we just need then to be able to interpret those symptoms and to know how best to support ourselves. And when we have a symptom, quite often that in itself brings up fear. What's wrong with me? Where's this going to go? How's it going to end? When's it going to end? All of these things can be very stressful, and that can push us back into the stress rather than allowing our body to go through the healing process. So this knowledge has been really empowering to me. I used to be so afraid of getting sick. I used to be so afraid of everything. But understanding that, I can now know what action to take and how to take it to support myself to get well. So that's what I love to share with people, to give them, like you were saying in the introduction, that vocabulary, that understanding, so that they can then know how best to support themselves and have their own tools, because it's very individual as well. Trauma is a very unique and individual thing. Gabor Mate says it's not what happens to us, it's how we respond to what happens to us. And of course, that is going to be unique to each individual. So knowing that, I've been able to understand myself more deeply, have more compassion for myself, and more knowledge of, like we talked about before, who I am, my best self, and how I can move closer to that and be strong and have my power, my authentic power back through doing that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Yes, it's I've had shingles myself, and definitely sympathise. Have you had shingles yet?
No, I've not had shingles. What does it entail? What's the symptomatic?
Well, I had shingles in France, which complicated the issue somewhat. We were travelling all over, and I don't speak French, but we had somebody in the party who did. So they took me into hospital, and he had this long conversation with the French doctor, and all he ever said was d'accord, which means I understand. And he turned and he said to me, "I'm sorry, Chris, you've got eczema." And they prescribed some antihistamine cream, which was totally useless. So I was putting that on, and eventually I got back to Britain and travelled home via Birmingham for some reason. And I went to the GP, and he had a look, and he says, one glance, he says, "That's shingles." But I was very, it's very interesting hearing what Robin was saying, because for me it was the left arm, for Robin it was the right leg, and there was a massive amount in the upper arm, sort of round, just from the armpit. There were four or five, they're like boils, four or five on my under wrist and one on the tip of the third finger. And I said to the doctor, "Why?" And he said, "Well, it follows the nerve." there's a single nerve that follows the same. And I wanted to ask you, Robin, do you go down to that sort of detail? I mean, if there's a particular nerve that the shingles is following, does that mean anything, or is it just an accident?
Oh, it's not an accident. None of it is an accident. And I wouldn't necessarily say which nerve it was or anything. And for me, it doesn't. It doesn't. There is no specific line, and it doesn't, like you say, come down and like the tip of a toe or something. But where it is significant. Mm-hmm. And again, the body knows, and the body is so metaphorical. And like traditional Chinese medicine talks about qi and qi lines and where they're blocked. And that's what it is, that the body is holding energy somewhere, but where it's holding it is significant, and it gives us a lot of information. So it would be interesting to explore why it was that particular finger. And our fingers do, when you're doing EFT or something, which is one of the therapies that I use, there are specific points for each finger and what they mean. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to look at which way you're wired and
It was a long time ago. It's about 40 years ago now, sometime in the 80s.
But that's the sort of thing that I would look at with somebody. What are their symptoms? Where are they experiencing those symptoms? And what is their personality? What themes, what beliefs do they hold? Because it's all clues. It's like being a detective. It's all clues that help to build up the picture of understanding what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it may have had something to do with, because I'm very introverted, and I was travelling around France with a group of people who I knew quite well, but I wouldn't have called them close friends. We were there, we were part of the peace movement. We were there. I can't actually remember what we were, all the detail of what we were doing, but we had some good meals. I think sometimes I feel sort of locked in with with people, and particularly in the vehicle where you're very close together. I don't sit there thinking, oh dear, how do I get out of here? I'm not sort of consciously worried, but I think
it's an unconscious
level. I often find that quite,
a lot of it is, unconscious.
Sorry, Chris, do you have anything else to say on?
No, that's...
I was going to say, because I've been working with a couple of people at the moment on my womb area, and I suppose that's like the feminine place, isn't it? And just creation.
It's a creative space.
Which is the space which I work with the most, I guess, because Creative Hearts is, and everything I do in terms of the writing and songwriting. And but I think there's a lot of pain there and grief because of perhaps creations that haven't lived their full potential yet. Or maybe never will. And I do think that creates, it's painful. And I think that the body is just a reflection of what's going on within us. And, I kind of say it like, if a baby was crying, you wouldn't just kind of, I don't know, give it something to start. I don't know. I don't want to put down other ways of solving things, but, you'd show it love and you'd give it food and nurture. So I think we need to do that with our bodies. Because when it's pain, when there's some kind of symptom, that's our body's crying out for attention. It's saying, please see me. Please hear me.
I often say to people, it's like nurturing, mm-hmm. parenting our inner mm-hmm. child with the parenting that we might not have had ourselves. Not to blame the parents and what they were doing. They did the best that they knew how, but they probably weren't. And if you think back, my parents are 60s parents, so I was born in 68. And the teachings that were around at that time were not what a child actually needs. Things like, leave your baby to cry, they will learn how to self-soothe. Feed your baby on a 4-hour rotation. And Gabor Mate, again, in his book, he talks a lot about all of that and how traumatic that is for the child, because the child can't rationalize and say, well, my parents are working or they're busy, or the child just knows, I'm not getting what I need. And because the child is the center of their universe, then they are responsible for not getting what they need. So then, evidently, I'm not good enough, because people aren't giving me what I need. I'm not getting the food, the nurture, the whatever it is. So, you know, saying that your womb space is your creative space, I think it's also that nurturing space.
Yeah.
It's that loving space.
Yeah. And
that maternal space.
Yeah, and I think it's just an invitation to be more of those things, you know, to go into the mother archetype. You know, Chris was talking about Jungian archetypes, and I've been connecting to that mother archetype, even though I'm not a mother in terms of I don't have children. But I feel it's really important to connect to that space of being a mother because of the archetypes, qualities, characteristics that we all need, no matter what gender we are. You know, we need those things, or what age
we are, or where we are in our life.
Yeah. So I'm grateful to have, you know, these sessions. I had one with Audrey, who's been on the podcast. I don't know what episode it is, but Audrey Scully was on our a few episodes ago.
Episode 30.
And so I had a session with her doing some Tao healing on it and some reflexology. And then I had one with Jan, who is a magical muse, I think is her business. So I'm doing some shamanic womb healing with her as well. So yeah, I find it really exciting, and I'm grateful that, you know, because if I didn't have these symptoms, I probably wouldn't be having sessions with these amazing women who, you know, are a bit older than me. Not that it matters what age you are, but they have a lot of wisdom to give, and nurture as well. So it's, you know, I'm grateful that through the symptoms, I'm then able to receive the nurture from those around me that I know who have these gifts.
And for me, that's why we have symptoms, that it enables us to receive what we need and to make those connections.
Right. Yeah. Because even we probably wouldn't even be here today in this, you know, if we hadn't have had all the things that have happened in our lives. And yeah, it kind of goes into, I'll go into my part of the talking about the seasons as well, because it kind of goes with the same point of what we're saying here, is like, you can't separate what's happened in your life with what is happening now, if that makes sense, because everything that we go through and everything that we're surrounded by affects everything. So with the seasons, I was thinking about how the seasons affect creativity. So, for example, in winter, you might be doing more hibernation time. So there might be more resting and kind of family time, where you may be just creating a nice warm environment. And in terms of projects, it might be kind of finishing things off or putting things out that's already completed, you know, the completion kind of phase. And it also may be kind of just allowing things to settle and allowing ideas to sort of brew within, yeah, percolate, yeah. And then now we're moving into spring, and as I was walking to Audrey's house, this was the day after spring equinox, and I really felt the energy of spring. It started to be more sunny. I was noticing the flowers and the birds, and I just felt a little perking up in my energy. And I think spring is about trying out things, being playful, trying new things, going outside more. You know, I went outside for the first time in terms of sitting in my garden. I haven't done that in the winter because it's been too cold. So, and it's still a little bit rainy. Like, I tried today again and it started raining, but at least there's that impetus to get outside, to, you know, like the flowers are just sort of poking out. It's not quite full in bloom. So the ideas might be, you know, starting to get some ideas for new creations. It may be trying out some new tools. So, you know, you may be trying some new classes or workshops, or just seeing what there is to create, and you know, seeing what new business models you might have or something like that. And then in summer, that's when you really get to experience the fruits of your labor and what's come about. And I always do loads of gigs in summer, loads of festivals and, you know, talks and workshops and things where people are gathering together. So it's a really fun time in summer because you can really enjoy your creations and share them with others. So I feel like that's a perfect time. It's not that you can't do these things in the other seasons. You can, and I have, but it's just about the energy, energetically. So it's just moving with the energy instead of against it. And the autumn time is about, you know, the more disciplined aspects. So it might be stuff like organizational, or, you know, tidying your space or creating folders and, you know, putting things into order. A bit more like letting go of the old, shedding the old. So, you know, the leaves are dropping. So you're getting rid of the old creation, you know, maybe just saying, right, I don't need that part. So when you're doing editing, for example, in a song, I might be going through the song and going, no, not that bit. I'm going to cut that bit. I'm going to get rid of that bit and then keep this bit. And it's just kind of refining, tuning up. So, and these also, I work with these, the seasons with the menstrual cycle as well. So it comes back to the womb. So I will do, when it's ovulation, that's the summer. And then you have autumn is the premenstrual. Then you have menstrual, which is winter, and then spring, which is pre-ovulation. So for any women that have a menstrual cycle, or anyone, even if you don't have a menstrual cycle, then you can use the moon as well. The cycles of the moon are the same. So there seems to be these cycles in nature, and they're really useful when it comes to creating, and they're useful to know what cycle am I in at the moment, what part of my cycle or the earth cycle, the seasons are we in, to know how best to use your energy and not to push too much in one direction if there's a different energy in the season, if this makes any sense. So if anyone has anything to share on what I've just said, yeah.
They say that about life as well, don't they? the springtime of your life, the summer of your life, the autumn yeah. of your life. I think there, yeah, absolutely. Life has so many rhythms and the ebb and the flow of the tide and all of these things that when we can go with them, it serves us so much better rather yeah. than, like you were saying, pushing because we feel we have to or we should.
Yeah.
Just the energy. Yeah. You can feel that it's hard rather than flowing.
Yeah.
And if we accept that our life will have different seasons and different seasons within each of those years or months or weeks,
yeah,
that really serves us.
I also want to credit Red School as well. Wild Power is the book, so on the menstrual cycles, just because I know a lot of what I've just said relates to their work, so I want to credit them where credit's due. So yeah, a really great book for on the menstrual cycle and creating. So yeah, Chris, any thoughts on the seasons or anything I've said?
Yes, just picking up very briefly something that Robin said. There's a lovely song, and I think it's called From May to September. And if I can find it on YouTube, I'll put it in the show notes. And it's a very moving song with a lovely tune. Not quite sure how relevant it is, but that just occurred to me. Now, the thing I wanted to pick up on is one of the things that I live through every year is the liturgical year, because I'm a Methodist local preacher. And I think it's very important to know where we are in telling the story. And it's a long story. It begins usually at the end of November, beginning of December, with Advent. And that's both the coming of Jesus, the theological term is incarnation, but it's also the second coming. Lo, he comes in clouds descending. So it's the end of the old story and the beginning of the new story. But the interesting thing is the Christmas season, which is Advent, Christmas and Epiphany, is solar. So it follows the sun and it covers that time when the days are shortest and the sun's most absent, as it were. And that is why Christmas always falls on the 25th. Doesn't matter what day of the week it is, but it's always on the same date. And everything else in that season is always on the same date. We're currently in Lent, which is the beginning of the Easter season. It's for just over six weeks of Lent. And the Easter season is the lunar time. So there, everything always falls on the same day, but not on the same date. And there's various ways you can handle that. It gets complex because of the way we've arranged all our calendars. In Islam, Ramadan, there's 13 lunar months in the year as opposed to 12 solar months. And so Ramadan and Eid go backwards 4 months because they celebrate every 12 lunar months. So it falls backwards. I'm not never quite sure how they work out where the date of Easter. I have this vision of three very, very ancient monks in a monastery on the top of a mountain somewhere who spent all their time determining the date, and they're about 6 years ahead and they're slowly working it out. But anyway, whatever it is, the reason it moves about, and sometimes Easter's early and sometimes it's late, is because it fits with the lunar pattern, and obviously that takes the story from the incarnation. You get the baptism, the ministry of Jesus, and then we're just coming now. This coming Sunday is Passion Sunday, when we remember the whole story of the cross, and then it's Palm Sunday, and then it's Easter. So we're actually coming to the sort of crux of the story. And then you get the resurrection and then Ascension Day, and that's all part of the East, the Easter period, and it's all lunar. So it's interesting, and if you look at different faiths, you can see how they follow both solar and lunar festivals in different ways. And I suspect that the body, well, people talk about things like seasonally affective disorder. That might not be the most positive way of looking at it, come to think of it, but it's when the sun is most absent. A lot of people feel that. So the solar cycle influences us, and you've talked about the menstrual cycle, which is a lunar cycle.
Yeah.
But in terms of the seasonal affective disorder, just to know that we are so much a part of nature, we're such a high percentage water, so the moon does affect us because it still works on the water in our bodies the same way as it does the tides, but that we evolved right in there in alongside of nature. So of course we're dependent on the sun, and of course at winter seasons, you were mentioning, Gemma, we will naturally go into that hibernation mode because the days are shorter. We need to rest. We need to take that time and space and all of those things. So with seasonal affective disorder, is that a disorder, or is it the fact that our bodies are just responding naturally to our environment, but our lives and our society don't allow for that? Because we're supposed to be equally active all the way through the year. We have electric lights now. What's your problem? But electric lights aren't sunlight, and they don't give us the energy in the way that the sun does. So with a lot of these things, I think it's more about understanding how our bodies actually work and how it all relates together, rather than saying you've got a disorder. But maybe you need to appreciate
it. I think part of the problem, isn't it, that we immediately go to it's a disorder, there's something wrong, and we need to fix it, instead of going from the opposite perspective, which is what you're suggesting, is there's something right, and this is a response to something that's not in order. So rather than seeing our bodies as wrong, we're seeing the way that the society is structured as, again, we wouldn't even use the word wrong, just not helpful. Not necessarily,
it's just
serving.
Not serving those individuals. Some people may cope with it much better. Not everybody has that seasonal affective disorder.
I think there's something else, Gemma. This isn't a criticism of what you said, but I did notice that you didn't say anything about there being a season when you relax.
Yeah, winter.
Take time out.
Winter.
But you were finishing things off and...
allowing things to settle.
Well, what I wanted to say is...
maybe I didn't make a big point of it being relaxation time.
Okay. I think the Christmas celebration is a very good example of that, and there are similar things in other traditions. But what I wanted to say is the lunar cycle is 4 weeks, 28 days. A tradition, and I haven't found any books so far that really sort of look at the tradition of the 7-day week, but I don't think it's absolutely universal in all civilizations, but it's almost universal now. And usually at least one of those days is time off, for recreation or whatever. It's not always the same day in every tradition. And some people would say it's the whole weekend off or whatever, but there is that time to rest, or resting might be, taking part in sports or something like that. It doesn't have to be sitting on a chair or lying on a bed or whatever. But there's the rest and recreation as part of life, and that's sort of plumbed into the way we experience the passage of time.
Yeah, it's very important because they say in like sport, if you don't rest, the muscles don't have time to grow. So it's the same with creativity or productivity, anything that you're doing. If you don't take time to rest, you don't, the work doesn't have chance to grow. It won't naturally become what it's supposed to be in a organic way, because you're just always pushing to do something, and that's not how life works. There's ebbs and flows, but I mean, I've been feeling really, I don't know, I kind of have a thing around just feeling really tired lately, and I don't know whether it's like there's something around that balance of when you work for yourself and you don't have those clear days. I do try and take Sunday off, but it's sometimes hard when you have your phone and people are messaging and saying, can you do this, and da da da. And then other days, it's almost like I'm just resting all day long and just not doing things, and then going, oh, I haven't done this work, and then feeling bad about it. So I don't know whether there's just something that it is about getting the balance of when we do things and trying to work a bit more with those cycles in a more healthier way.
And I think there's also something, particularly when we work for ourselves, of putting those boundaries in place. Yeah. Phone goes off on Sunday, yeah. Or don't contact me on a Sunday, or if you do, that's fine, yeah. But I won't respond until the next working day, which is a real challenge to set that up. And it's what works for the individual.
Yeah.
But I think absolutely it's so important to rest.
So, Chris, you're going to talk about your backyard.
Right, yes. I was just going to say, this is one of the positives of being a pensioner, that you can have your day off whenever you like.
Well, I can as well, because I'm self-employed, but it doesn't make it easier, yes, necessarily.
I wouldn't have thought that working for the church allowed that.
Well, I don't work for the church. I donate some time. It does mean that I tend to be quite active on Sundays, other days of the week. Anyway, yes, I wanted to talk about location, the place where we live. And I think there's an alchemy, just as we've had an alchemy of well-being and of seasons, I think there's also an alchemy of place. If you don't agree, either of you, you'll get a chance to debate it shortly. And I've just completed for the fifth or sixth time Megan Macedo's writing challenge. And I decided as my topic to write for 21 days about Sheffield, the city where I live. And what I'm going to do is to read just one of them. This is day five. That I'm going to read the photograph of my backyard that Gemma mentioned will be in the show notes. So if you want to look at my backyard, you can do that. And if you don't, then you're quite free to make that choice. And the idea of the writing challenge is that we just write something every day, not a lot of editing. But it's just to get new ideas and new insights sort of flowing. So this is the one I wrote for day five. The title is Why Sheffield? Now then, you could take this question two ways. Why does Sheffield exist? Or why do I live here? The answer to the first question is very interesting, and who knows, maybe one day I'll answer it. But today, I'm going to have a go at the second. The house in the photo is my house. I took it round the back with wheelie bins and all, and you'll note the letterbox in the back door. This is because in Sheffield, you go round the back. The postperson might have an easier job if the letterboxes are on the front, and some of them are, just to keep them on their toes. There is a reason for this. These were originally railway workers' cottages built around 1911. The end houses on the terrace are bigger, and that's where the foreman lived. The house on the right has a kitchen extension, but my back room doubles as the kitchen. The front door is known locally as the coffin door. This is because it opens directly into the front room, so you use it only the last time you leave the house feet first. You don't want everybody trailing muck into the front room, which has a nice carpet. Of course, I'm unlikely to be laid out in my front room because I doubt anyone will want to visit my lifeless body. They're not terribly keen about visiting me while I display signs of life. Anyway, knowing my luck, I'll leave my house and be mowed down by a metaphorical or proverbial bus, and so not have a chance to leave in the way of my dreams. Anyhow, I'm supposed to explain why I live here, which is easier than explaining how I'll die here. First up, I was born in Sheffield, and so didn't have any choice or say in the matter. We lived at Hunter's Bar, which is going on towards the wealthiest side of the city, although it is wealthier now than it was then. After 17 years, I moved north, at first to York and then to the northeast. I was away for most of 17 years, with a break when I returned to Sheffield to study at the Urban Theology Unit for 1 year. In 1989, I decided to return. There were several reasons for this. I had many friends in Sheffield, and it seemed a livelier place than Middlesbrough, where I was living at the time. I wasn't unhappy where I was, just thought the grass was greener in Sheffield. But in 1988, my mother died, and I was concerned about my father on his own. He was stronger than I thought, but I think appreciated having me around. Why Pitsmoor and the coffin door? It was close to the Urban Theology Unit, and at the time we had a walking distance community. Now UTU is in the city centre, and most of the community has moved on. There's still a few knocking around, and we nod as we pass one another and tell each other how bad the weather is. It doesn't get too exciting, and so you see, that's why Sheffield.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I want to hear more of your Sheffield stories. So you're going to have them on Seventh Wave? Have you put it up on your blog yet?
Yes, they're on the way. Mm-hmm.
So what makes you so interested in writing about Sheffield?
Well, part of it is I get into a lot of conversations around the sorts of things we've been discussing today, wellness and health and so on, with you, Gemma, and Robin and Audrey, who we've mentioned, and many others. And one of the things that I feel is important is that the place where we live has a massive impact on our well-being, and it's not an easy equation. You know, it's not, if you live in the middle of a big city with lots of pollution, you're going to be miserable, and if you live out in the country with lots of cows, you'd be happy. That's not, you know, that's a very superficial way of looking at it. But the thing is, everything we perceive is actually inside our heads.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we can compare notes, and we know that my back door's got a letterbox, and everybody can see and perceive that. But it's still inside our heads, and it's also the stories that we tell about the place. And one of the phrases that I coined in recent years is anonymous legacy, and that works in two ways. There are things that you have done that when the day comes and you pass to another life, you'll leave behind. And I have little wood, which is my main thing. That, you know, it's been there for 20 or 30 years. I organised the people who planted it. And but no, even though I've told loads of people, nobody will remember me, you know. And there are others who would claim equally to have planted it because a group of us did that. But that's my anonymous legacy. That's one way it works. The other way it works is that everything around us is an anonymous legacy. So, you know, the house that you're in was built by somebody, probably not you. And I suspect you have no idea who it was, probably a very vague idea as to when it was. But they built it, and they may have left their little a little something that they put on everything that they worked on, which you wouldn't probably notice and whatever. But they left that, and you're using it. You're there. You're using it, and most of the things around us were created. Tens, hundreds, in a few cases even thousands of years ago, by the people who went before us, just as we create stuff that is inherited or will be inherited by future generations. And I think this is, I think it's really important. You know, when you're a kid, you see the world and you think it's unchanging, because you've only lived for a few years and it's mostly pretty much the same. But then as you get older, you begin to see that things do change and turn over. And in several of the stories, I mentioned Oil Int Road in Sheffield, which was a major, massive thing in the 1960s. It was basically an improvement to the shopping centre. I won't go into all the details here. But it's gone. It disappeared. It was there for about 30 years, and it disappeared in the 90s, about 30 years ago. And yet people still talk about it.
I was just going to say, I've always loved and always find very precious and special old buildings. So I love ruined castles, ruined abbeys, where I grew up in Belfast, and there were a lot of places around the north that we would visit, old stone, standing stones, that sort of thing. And I love that idea of this legacy. And I'm not so interested in recent history in that way. I am in another way, but it's the old history, the history of the land, sort of. So like you're saying, location, that's not just necessarily a building, but a place. And a place that's maybe no longer used in the way that it was, so a castle or an abbey, but it still has something of that energy in it. And I've always wished that I had a time machine and I could go back through the ages to see how it developed. And like you were saying about that shopping precinct, to see how it came about and then disappeared again. And all that went on around that. And my grandmother, she lived to 103 and she was born in 1900, same year as the Queen Mother. So she lived in the outskirts of Belfast, so where it's now a part of Belfast City, where she grew up, it was a little village out in the sticks. And for her, everything was delivered by horse and cart, no cars. And the tall ships weren't a tourist attraction, they were for rail. That was how things were moved from country to country. So all of those changes, she lived through two world wars, she saw airplanes. And because she lived up to 2000, she wasn't into, but mobile phones and computers and all of these things came in her lifetime. Because that was one of, you know, everything is speeding up, the changes and the transitions and the developments. She saw all of that, and it just blows my mind that there are people who've lived through all of that and have that story within themselves.
Yeah. Chris, I'm thinking we've talked about this topic before, haven't we, on different podcast. So I'm trying to think what episode we talked about this topic. Do you remember?
I can't remember offhand.
Mm. But we've definitely... I just keep noticing some themes coming up, and I'm going to be making some more little clips of various podcasts. I'm a little behind of doing them, but so I've been coming back to older podcasts and creating little reels of them. And it's interesting having a listen to the episodes and seeing what topics keep coming up and keep we go into maybe a new element of that same topic. And I do find it fascinating because with different people where these same themes, it's a bit like seasons, you kind of come back to winter and then you go back to summer, and do you know what I mean? It's things, mm-hmm. things come around again. And there's always a reason, like you were saying, about the symptoms. There's a reason why certain topics we talk about or we're fascinated in, or we have friends that we will discuss various things.
Or why they come up yeah. at a certain time as well.
Yeah. Because yeah. it always seems like the guest brings... whatever I'm working on, it's really strange. Like today I was just, you know, reading about, you know, health and this and how the mind affects it, and you know, and then that's what we're talking about, and it's been similar on other ones where we've had guests on and they talk about something and it is what I'm actually going through or working on.
And people talk about coincidences, but that's basically just a coincidence or a synchronicity. I think
I love that.
Yeah, that's another Jungian word, synchronicity. Mm. Yeah, and I think there is something about overall well-being in the place where you mm-hmm. live, because as you learn more about the past, you begin to... feel, I suppose, a sort of solidarity with the people who went before. And I mean, I did a very, very tiny amount of research into Sheffield Castle, and one of the stories is about the castle. But what I do is I take people back through time to the time before the castle, and also we do a quick glimpse of the future as well. And then after that, I found this book, which is called Here, by Richard Maguire, and I'll put the. It's a graphic novel, and I'll just find a suitable page. Yeah, every scene in the novel is
a different room
taken from is drawn from the same spot, and it's the corner of a room. So there's a fireplace and a window. It's the same room, but at different times. So this is 1980. The one I mean, obviously, people who are listening can't hear this, but the one I'm showing you is 1989. and as the story goes on, it goes into the deeper past before the house existed, and it's in America, but it could almost be England, because they play charades and Christmas parties and all looks very similar. But then you go back, as they go back in time, you get the Native Americans, and it goes back to sort of the very earliest ages. And then you also get a glimpse of the future of the room. But I thought towards the end, you see a man with a spade digging a trench, and it's the foundations for the house that the room's in. So you actually see the building going up as well, which is great. But what it shows is you can research the story of your house. You know, the stuff around, one of the people we had on the podcast, John Chapman, does that. He researches ancestors, but also he can research your house for you as well, and who lived there, and its story. And this is what I mean by the legacy. It's there's layer upon layer upon layer of people's lives, and you just live on the top of it. And I think that's a great comfort. It gives you that perspective, and somehow I find it comforting anyway.
And if you think of it in terms of chakras, our base chakra is our root, where we ground. And if we know where that connects to, and connects not only to the ground, but to our past and our ancestors and our history. And you mentioned in the introduction for me that I worked as an interpreter for many years, and the deaf community didn't have that history because they, like the Native Americans, they were taken away from their families, because 95% of deaf people are born to hearing parents. So it's not like you're French and you're born to French parents. It's like being born into a family that you're not the same as. Mm. So they maybe were taken away from their families. And they didn't have a sense of history, because where's deaf history? Where's it recorded? And who passes it on? But now there has been a whole load of research done and collections made, and they have a history now. And it's rich with art and culture. And the deaf community has really celebrated getting that, because like you're saying, it's kind of like putting you on the map, isn't it? It's giving you a location. It's giving you roots.
Yeah.
It's showing where you come from. And that gives you something to stand on. Otherwise, you haven't got a rock beneath you. You're standing on sand.
Yeah. I'm still working through how I feel about living here and having to come back, because I was saying to Chris the other day, you know, I never thought it was a choice. I felt like I was forced to come back because of lack of resources for myself. And I've not really come to terms with being here. And I think there's part of it I have, and I appreciate all the people that I'm meeting and knowing, that obviously I wouldn't meet and know if I hadn't have come back home. And I am doing a lot of ancestral work, and I'm doing a lot of grounding and rooting, and even these conversations around Sheffield. So it's interesting, maybe that's part of my spiritual journey that I still have resistance to, because I just want to have loads of money so I can just move wherever I want. Not even loads, just a normal amount. but that's just, I don't know. Yeah, so it's kind of been hard because I haven't, and I can see how, you know, because they were saying to me the other day, well, I've chosen to invest in healing rather than a house, you know, rather than moving somewhere or setting up a new life somewhere else. I've chosen to invest. So it's not that the money hasn't been there. It's been that I have invested in my music and my healing and modalities and training, you know, as a coach and Reiki. So I suppose there is that element of choice that I have chosen to stay here and focus on that, but there's still something in my mind, and I'm not asking you to solve this right now, or anyone listening either, but although if you do have an idea, let me know. But yeah, I just, it's interesting how coming to terms with where you're from or where you are and how that links, and you know, the difference between where I thought I'd be at this age and where I actually am. You know, I never said I wanted to live in the place I was born. That was never part of my plan, but it's happened, and I have to accept that, and I have to kind of, or maybe part of the journey is about rooting and grounding to history and, you know, where I'm from. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Chris. And thank you, Robin, for being on the podcast. If people want to find out more, how do we do that? Robin.
If anybody wants to connect with me, there's my website. And I'm going to have to spell this because it's a rather strange name. But it's equenergy.com. So that's EQUENERGY.com. And on there at the top, there are lots of tabs. And you can then just go to resources. It's got all my links list in there. There's a Let's Connect, which has my email, my WhatsApp. You can book a Zoom call with me if anybody's interested in having a conversation, because I love connecting with people. I love talking about all of this stuff. So, and I'm on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn for socials. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Robin.
And YouTube.
And if you want to find out about myself, you can go on Gemma Rosenthal and my sites and creativehearts.coach. On YouTube, I have lots of music and videos and coaching on there. And I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. So you can follow me, and Twitter, all of them, pretty much TikTok, all the sites. Chris?
Yes, I shall put the links to the Seventh Wave blog posts, which will be covering all the Sheffield location. And every day I went out and took a photograph as well as writing something. So you'll get a rather strangely skewed image of Sheffield if you don't know Sheffield. But I think in a way it speaks to wherever you are. I'm trying to explore, you know, how do we get hold of that space. I'm also continuing to do Telling Stories, Making Business. Some of those are on Zoom and some of them are in a cafe in Sheffield, depending on where the storyteller's based. If anybody would like to have a go at telling a story and getting feedback from me plus a few other people, then usually business owners, then do get in touch. And we have some rather amazing conversations at those meetings, which do not get recorded deliberately, because stories are supposed to pass. Mm-hmm. What about
everybody's
creative heart?
I've shared. So thank you for listening to the podcast, and check out the other episodes. And yeah, thank you for being here, Robin.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. And thank you for listening. Goodbye.